The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is the fifth day of the seven-day session here at Mountain Gate, quite a ways into the fifth day, very close to when it begins to be the sixth day. Goes by rather fast when we're really working hard. And it's wonderful to see that everyone here really is working hard. That's the way to work your way towards significant freedom, true freedom, the only true freedom that there is, really. And that's freedom from all the stuff that we carry around with us, our ideas, our assumptions, our baggage, our conditioning. And as we begin to be able to let that go, we find ourselves with more breathing room. And hopefully that inspires us to go deeper yet, because we can keep on going and it makes a huge difference, not only in our own lives, but also the lives of others. I'd like to share with you now today, again, some more of the spiritual autobiography of Zen Master Hakuin, is what it's titled, called Wild Ivy. I have an interesting way of naming books in Japan. Wild Ivy is one of them. Idle Talks on a Night Boat is another section of talks or writings by Hakuin. They're very colorful titles. Idle Talks on a Night Boat is also included in Wild Ivy to a certain degree, and the idea being it's being downplayed as teaching. Idle Talks on a Night Boat, people traveling by night on a boat going a long way, strangers talking to each other, just chatting about usually inconsequential stuff, and so he's downplaying the depth of teaching that he's offering when he talks about that title, or when he assigns that title. And it's translated as a number of other writings of Hakuin are by Norman Waddell, who is living in Japan, has lived in Japan since he was a student of poetry. I went to Japan to study poetry with R.H. Blythe, and has remained there and somehow found himself translating Hakuin, which is a true gift to the world. Because Hakuin, his teachings are strong and deep, and his rambunctious personality comes out through them. And he had quite a voyage. His path of awakening. I say path of awakenings because he wrote somewhere or other that he had had 19 deep awakening experiences and countless more shallow ones. And so this is another teaching of his, just in that sentence, that we should not be satisfied with one single kensho, but we should keep going because it gets more and more free the deeper we go. And of course we have to meet stuff along the way, which he has had to do as well, and that's where we're going to jump into this story. We started Sesshin with a little bit of his background. He was born into a family that had an inn along the post road, along the highway to Tokyo at the time, although it was called Edo at the time, and the daimyos in that era were required twice a year to come to Edo, to the court, And I don't know whether it was required that they come with great pomp and circumstance. I think it was. Or whether they just chose to. But at any rate, it was a ploy to get them to spend so much money that they had nothing left to rebel or to start an insurgency. And these colorful processions would come along that road, and it was Hawkwind's family that was responsible for providing them with fresh horses and so on and so forth. And they came with quite a caravan of people. It was really like a circus show, a traveling circus show, performing all along the way. And there are some paintings of Hawkwind that actually depict those events. And he alludes to them as well in some of his long teaching poems. So we're going to jump into his life. I think he was around 19 years old. Well, I guess it was 18 years old. And so he did get ordained at Shōinji, which was the family temple, in which he eventually brought back from ruin many, many, many years later. His uncle had it, and it had fallen into disrepair, and eventually Hakuinen went back and repaired it, and monks began to gather around him. By this time, he had quite a few Kensho experiences and had gone quite deep. So little by little, more and more monks began to train with him. I went to Shōinji and became a monk at age 14. Beginning that very same spring, I began serving as an attendant of Nyoka Roshi. During this period, I read my way through the five Confucian classics and studied the literary anthology Wen Shan from cover to cover. This was kind of a traditional way of study in Japan. They were very much into the Confucian classics. And there is still at least an old Confucian school in the area close enough that people could go visit it from Sōgenji. I don't know that it was actually running at the time, but it was certainly there. When I turned 18, I accompanied Kin Shuso to the city of Shimizu, where we were admitted to the assembly of monks at the Zensoji. In the course of one of the lectures there, the story of Yento the ferryman came up. Now, Yento is Ganto in the way of pronouncing his characters in Japanese. And Ganto, there are a number of stories about him, and he was a deeply realized monk. He became a teacher, master, at a rather early age. He was in his early 50s, and he operated as a ferryman. He would ferry travelers across a river at a particular point. It was an era when there was a great deal of unrest in China, and so for him not to actually have an active temple, but rather to do this other kind of work, made a lot of sense back then. Unfortunately, however, Ganto was set upon by bandits at a certain point and murdered. And you heard also in that first day's Teisho, that when he was skewered with a sword, that's how they fought in Japan, their weapons were swords, he screamed so loud it was heard 9 miles away. And when Hakuin read this, he went into deep depression, because as you heard, he had become a monk, begged his parents to become ordained. Took him a year to convince them that that's the course he should follow, because he thought that that was the only way he was going to escape hell. And here he finds out that this eminent monk not just an ordinary monk, but a very famous monk, a very highly regarded monk, had screamed when he was murdered, and not only that, he'd been murdered. And so that certainly popped Hockring's balloon in terms of his hopes of avoiding hell, as far as he could tell. And this is another example of how our minds can work and cause us a great deal of problems. We can jump to conclusions about things and cause ourselves a lot of suffering, unnecessarily so. And what our practice is about is seeking the deep truth, the deepest truth, what is beyond all these ideas, all these stories, all these images, all these assumptions, all this conditioning. Because that's the only place we'll really be free. And then, even if we also are murdered, it will be very different from if it happens when we're caught still in our stuff. At any rate, it sent Hockring into a deep funk, really a deep funk. He couldn't even get out of bed for 15 days. I'm not quite sure how he managed to stay in bed for 15 days, because in a training temple he wouldn't have been allowed to. But at any rate, he did. And then he just decided to give up practice and become a poet and a calligrapher. And he did. He studied the famous Chinese poets and calligraphers and began to have at it, and then began to realize that that wasn't going to bring him any lasting peace either. And so he was at a temple in despair, and glanced up at the, they call it a veranda. In Japan, it's called an engawa. Around the outside of temple buildings, there runs a narrow raised platform. It's a kind of a deck. And this is what he was referring to. And on the deck, on the engawa, were the rolled-up scrolls that had been out for their annual spring airing to hopefully prevent them from getting moldy in the extreme dampness of Japan. And also, they tend to treat them before they roll them up again with the kind of powder that discourages silverfish and other little bugs that eat scrolls, eat paper, or at least eat the paste. And he decided that he would go in and check these out. Maybe there was some form of inspiration up there. And we'll share again in his words, or the translation of his words. Let's say a little bit first about this period of depression. Brooding, pondering my future over and over, cudgeling my brain for some answer, I finally came to the conclusion that since there seemed to be no way at all to avoid entering the three paths in hell in the next life, I might as well join hands and take the leap into the conflagration along with everyone else. At the same time, I could see no point in just wasting the rest of my life, so I decided I would turn my attention to the study of calligraphy and the composition of Chinese poetry. I would try to earn universal praise as one of the master artists of the age. A matter of my future existence could take its own course. And so that's when he began to study the poets and the calligraphers. The following year, I set out on a pilgrimage to southern Mino province, drawn by the stories of a man named Bao Rojin. Rojin means old man. Incumbent of the Zuiunji in a village called Hino, northwest of Ogaki Castle. According to the reports, no one in the present day could compare with him in the field of poetry and letters. I traveled in a group with 12 other monks. On arriving at Zuiunji, We requested permission to stay and took up residence that same day in Bao's temple. Zuyinji was incomparably poor. Students even had to supply their own rice and firewood. As for Bao, he was known as the wild horse of Mino. Ba is with certain characters, that means horse in Japanese. He was by nature hard and sharp as flint, rough and ruthless to the core, as forbidding as they come. He spewed his venom wholesale. Everyone received an equal dose, regardless of rank or ability. As a result of this, the monks I'd come with were all soon anxious to leave and escape the old man. They decided to break up and go their separate ways. I was alone in my belief that another teacher with Bao's wide learning would be hard to find, even were I to search the entire country. As for his severity, I wasn't going to let that frighten me off. What rice and firewood I needed, and even luxuries such as miso and shoyu, I could manage out of my travel money, a gift from my mother that I still held in reserve. Whatever happened, I felt there was little cause for worry. I vowed to myself that I was not going to leave my newfound teacher, even if it should turn out to be the death of me. And then the other monks left. And it continues. From then on, through fair and foul, it was just the two of us. Whenever it wasn't actually raining, Bao would be off enjoying himself in Ogaki. Because of this, people around the temple would refer to a cloudless sky as a Bao sky. I would stay behind in the temple and devote myself quietly to my reading. There was a man named Onbazan, Bao's sole disciple at the time, and a poet of some reputation who would drop over from time to time and help me with a composition of linked verse. And then he goes into how that would happen. One day I was alone in the temple, turning things over in my head. It suddenly dawned on me that even in the unlikely event, I attained a skill in writing verse that surpassed the likes of a Li Po or Tu Fu. These are Chinese eminent poets. It still wouldn't help me to avoid falling into the three evil paths when I died. I sank once again into a very melancholy state, sadly regretting the situation in which I found myself. My gaze happened to turn to the far end of the veranda, where several hundred old books had been stacked after an airing on top of an old writing desk. The moment I saw them, I experienced an indescribable surge of joy. I promptly lit some incense and recited a sutra, and then I made three deep bows and vowed. All Buddhas in the 10 directions, all the gods who stand guard over the Dharma, I place my trust in you. If a way exists to which I can devote the rest of my life, I entreat you to make it known to me. Quietly approaching the desk and shutting my eyes, I stretched out my hand and blindly picked up one of the volumes. I raised it up several times in reverence, then lifted my eyelids. I had chosen a great treasure, spurring students through the Zen barrier. This book has recently been translated from the Chinese. It is available in English. Almost beside myself with joy, I opened it carefully and scanned the words printed on the page before me. I turned to a passage that described the great hardships the Chinese priest Tzu Ming underwent many years ago while he was studying under Zen master Fen Yang. The following year, I moved on to the Hofukuji in Horado and joined the assembly under Nanzen Osho. Nanzen had composed a verse to celebrate the new year. This we did at Sogenji as well. After the two December Ozushins, which were preceded by a November Ozushin, so that was two 7-day and 1 8-day sesshins in a row with only a couple of days in between. Then on the winter solstice, we had what was called Toji Toya, and it was a great celebration. We all broke out to have a big party at the temple. Even the Roshi came to it for the beginning part, and then he diplomatically left so everyone could enjoy themselves without feeling too self-conscious. And each year, the requirement was that we had to write a poem that described or reflected, not so much described, but reflected our state of mind in terms of depth of practice. And this was recited at the beginning of the Toji Toya event, and the Roshi would always comment on it, on each person's poem. There's a long tradition of eminent monks producing poems in the classic Chinese style, although we didn't have to do that at Sogenji. But the Roshi still does, and he does it on many different occasions, specifically New Year's, Bodhidharma's death anniversary, and various other events. And at Tahoma Monastery, he does them at the beginning and at the end of sesshins. So, here is Nanzen Osho's poem, "Brandishing the Taiya sword, a fistful of frost, he summons springtime back throughout the world. An auspicious light suffuses the abbot's chamber, old Mr. South offering incense for the new year." I presented this verse to Bao. Oh, this is his own. This is Hakuin's own, inspired by Nanzen's verse. And he presented it to Bao when he returned to the Zuiyonji, and Bao laughed and said, "Your position in the Brotherhood is sure to rise by the time of the summer retreat." And so he went back to Nanzen's temple, where there were 60 men by the end of the year, and advanced to the rank of third senior monk. So, there's another bit here. "During our stay in Matsuyama, rumors about the monks visiting the temple that summer being men of wide learning reached the ears of a high-ranking military retainer, a man whose family had served the local ruling clan for generations. He invited 5 monks from the Shōjūji to visit him at his residence for a chat or tea, and I was one of the monks selected to go. When the day came, we proceeded to his residence, and after exchanging words of introduction and small talk about the weather, our host brought out a collection of hanging scrolls to show us. There were about 20 scrolls, including calligraphy inscriptions, some of which our host confessed he was unable to decipher, which is not unusual." I once went to a calligraphy show in, it was an exhibition actually, in Okayama when I was living at Sogenji, because I was studying calligraphy myself, and my teacher every year usually won the top prize in this exhibition of calligraphers from all over the province. And as we went through and saw the different scrolls that had been submitted, they were all by premier calligraphers. I would ask my Japanese friend, you know, "What does that one say?" She'd say, "Well, I can tell you what the first 2 characters mean, but I don't know what the next 3 do, and I can tell you what the last 4 mean." And so it was. And there were scrolls that she could hardly decipher at all. And she also did calligraphy. And that is because there are various different styles of calligraphy in Japan. And one of them that I was fond of calling the doctor's handwriting style was almost indecipherable. You could hardly tell what characters were actually being representative, because they were like, I don't know if you're familiar with the style of signatures that Europeans often use. It's an indecipherable scribble. You can't tell really whose signature it is, because it doesn't really reflect a name. Anyway, it was like that. So it's no surprise that this gentleman couldn't read all his scrolls. Hearing that, the other monks all looked in my direction, their faces wreathed in broad grins. Okay, Hakuin, you're on. Let's see you stumble and fall. Probably because he had studied calligraphy. They were looking at him. There was one scroll in particular, an inscription in which the strokes of the characters were improperly written. No matter which way you read them, it was impossible to make out what the inscription said. While the others sat there with puckered brows, scratching their heads in bafflement, I took the scroll and wrote on the back of it the characters for mother-in-law and old woman. Their brows now furrowed into frowns, their fists clenched tightly at their sides. Now, what does that mean? Muttered one. That's very difficult to understand, too, another mumbled. Can't make it out at all, said a third. Please, Elder Monk, they said to me, get off your perch in the absolute. Come down into our relative world and tell us what it says. So, quote, descending from the clouds, close quote, I let them in on my little joke. Those two characters mean difficult to read. They responded in loud honks of laughter and much clapping of hands. There was one scroll that was nested in a set of double wooden boxes. This was encased in turn within a bag of fine silk brocade. We watched with a mixture of wonder and reverence as the scroll was carefully taken out for our inspection. It was a piece of calligraphy by Daigu Sochiku. His vigorous brush strokes and the words he had chosen both seemed altogether fitting and natural. Everything about it was just as it should be. I thought to myself, this is the product of truly enlightened activity. That calligraphy meant far more to me than any of the other scrolls, my interest in which now immediately vanished. As soon as I got back to the temple, I went to my quarters and assembled my small collection of inscriptions and paintings, about a score in all, some copybooks of calligraphy that had been made for me, drawings in calligraphy others had done at my request, which I'd always treasured, as well as a few specimens of my own brushwork. Bundling them up, I took them out into the cemetery, put them in front of one of the egg-shaped tombstones, and set fire to them. I watched until they were completely consumed by flames. So he's given up entertaining himself with thoughts of anything but the practice, and removed the distractions to that. From then on, I took spurring students through the Zen barrier as my master. Rededicated to my practice, I began pushing myself mercilessly day and night. While reading the three teachings of the Buddha patriarchs, I came upon a passage that made me leap up with joy. I compared a student practicing the great vehicle to a log floating down a river, never touching at either bank, finally makes its way out into the great ocean. In the spring, at the urging of a former brother monk, I traveled to Fukuyama and joined the brotherhood at the Tenshoji. This was the typical way of training in Japan of the era. The monks would travel around from temple to temple. This is not something that is recommended these days in America, because if you stick it out with one teacher, you're sooner or later going to meet all your stuff and have thereby the opportunity to clear it out and become free of it. It also can get rather confusing because different teachers have different styles and different instructions. And so it really is best to find your teacher and stick with that person. There, by virtue of hard and continuous application to my practice, I entered a pitch-dark cave. When I walked around or engaged in other activities, I wasn't even aware of what I was doing. When autumn came, I set out for home with a party of my fellow monks. We skirted the shores of the inland sea at Maiko, over the beaches of Suma. We passed the burial mound of the poet Hitomaru and the grave of Atsumori. We walked through the fields of Koyano and beside the woods of Ikuta, but my eyes were not open to any of those famous sights. All the way home, it seemed as if I were not moving at all, but standing on the road alone, The people, houses, and trees that lined the way were all moving westward. It took about a fortnight to reach home. My family, relatives, and friends all gathered to welcome me. They were anxious to hear me tell them tales of everything good and bad I had experienced during my absence, but all they got for their questions was an unresponsive series of sublingual grunts. This bewildered them. They accused me of having somehow changed. They told me that I had become a strange fellow. But my behavior at this time was perfectly in keeping with what that described in traditional accounts of other Zen practitioners passed down through the centuries. The National Master Kanzan, for example, is said to have walked the entire length of the Great Eastern Road 20 times without once looking up to notice Mount Fuji as he passed beneath it. I still remember the deep impression that story made on me when I first heard it. Filled me with an admiration for Master Kanzan that has never diminished. Flora Courtois, the American woman who had a deep and spontaneous, well, not so spontaneous because she worked hard to reach it, awakening experience while she was a college student at the University of Michigan. Run through a period of time when she was so absorbed in the question of, is there an underlying truth that is always true regardless of circumstance? And if so, what is it? That she wrote that at the time she was sort of boarding with a family. It was during the Great Depression. And the crash had happened between her first and second years of college. And so she was able to go back if she boarded with this family and did lighthouse work and watched the kids for a bit. And then she was free to go to school and study. And she had a room and she had food. And she said it would take her hours to do a simple little bit of ironing because she was so caught in that question. And another time, she was in a lecture in one of her college classes, and there was a visiting lecturer from Great Britain, and she was in a seat quite up front, right in front of the lectern, and at some point she had something of an insight, and it must have brought a look of great surprise onto her face, at which point the lecturer stopped his lecture completely and looked down at her and said, "Is there everything okay?" So when we are deeply absorbed in our practice, sometimes that kind of thing can happen. It doesn't always, but Hakuin was so completely and thoroughly dedicated to his practice, didn't have a job, didn't have a family to speak of, and his commitment was deep and thorough. For modern Americans, we have jobs, we have lives that involve family and other responsibilities, and so we don't have the opportunity to reach the kind of narrow focus that would express. But in a certain way, we have the possibility of going into a deeper focus because we are doing it in the midst of our daily lives. When we continue to give ourselves to the questioning, when there's a brief moment in the day where there's a transition point, we're about to go somewhere or come back from somewhere or move to a different task. If we do a single breath that time, just a single breath, but 100% given to it, deep curiosity, reaching through that breath, letting go everything external for that moment, then our practice naturally goes deeper. And not only does it go deeper, but it goes deeper in a way that we are able to integrate it in our daily life more readily than otherwise. Hakuin himself has said that to practice in the midst of activity offers 10,000 times that of seated zazen. Of course, we need both. The seated zazen is the fundamental basis for all the rest. But out and about in our daily life, and this is really very important for us who don't have so much time to come to formal sittings, don't have so much time to come to sesshin, that we actually do give ourselves completely, even for one breath, even for one breath. It makes an enormous difference. So, continue on. The practice is going deeper for each of you. It's very heartening to hear that you're sitting yaza because it makes a huge difference. Myself, in my earlier years, for decades, literally, I would sit, every sesshin, I would sit at least one all night. And every night I would sit several hours. Usually for me, I would get up early in the morning because that worked better for me than staying up late at night. But you have to work with your own body and your own internal clock. Push the envelope. Push the envelope. 7 days is a very short time. And you can make a great deal of progress in deepening your practice if you give yourself fully to it. I thank you for listening, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows.